Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. For many years, the conventional wisdom of evolution has been that natural selection is driven by individual traits and the bonds of genetic kinship. Parents make sacrifices for their children to improve and preserve their own genetic lineage for future generations. But now, after a lifetime of studying the social world of insects, Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist Edward O. Wilson seeks to overturn that conventional wisdom, some of it his own. In his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth, Wilson offers the provocative thesis that larger group membership actually trumps family ties as the driving force behind human evolution. We make sacrifices for the good of the group, even when there is no biological connection at stake. The idea has significant implications, not only for the natural world, but for how we think about war and peace, race relations, sports fandom, and arts and culture. Today on The Exchange, a conversation with author E.O. Wilson. Let's hear from you. What do you think of the idea that we need more than family, that we need groups to survive as a species? How do you think group affiliation has helped or hurt humanity? How do you understand the role of groups in the age-old debate of nature versus nurture? Call in. The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And joining us on the phone from his home in Lexington, Massachusetts, is author E.O. Wilson, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and author of more than 20 books. Mr. Wilson is regarded as one of the world's preeminent biologists and naturalists. He's also Professor Emeritus at Harvard University. Professor Wilson, welcome to The Exchange. It's a real pleasure to speak with you this morning.
Thank you so much.
Professor Wilson, let me start with a basic methodological question. Your work has tremendous implications for our understanding of human society, but as I just mentioned, your research is actually based on decades studying the natural world, ants, wasps, bees, and the likes, what you call social insects. How do sociobiologists like yourself make valid empirical connections between the insect world and the human world? Basically, how do we go from ants to human beings?
Actually, I've spent a good deal of my career since I first introduced sociobiology as a potential discipline in 1971, studying human behavior as well. And the book, The Social Dominance of Earth, is actually based on 10 years of study of the primary literature in scientific journals dealing with human behavior. So this actually emerges, this latest argument emerges from a very close study of humans added to. And here we have an area that has been mostly neglected by those who interpret human behavior, adding the what we know about the origin of social behavior in animals. So this is, I believe, the first comprehensive review that you can produce, you can get from science in a number of years.
So, though, when you spent those many years studying social insects, was part of the goal to theorize about human behavior, or was this something that developed on a parallel track, perhaps, or was that your attention all along?
In 1975, when I published Sociobiology, the new synthesis, my intention was to deal mostly with animals, but then I added on humans to make the picture complete.
Can you, and I wanted to take a step back at the beginning of the hour to the mid-70s. As you mentioned, it was the time of your landmark book, Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. Can you give our listeners a little bit of a sense of what you mean by sociobiology, and also a sense of what you're thinking on evolution, social behavior and kinship was at that time? And then when we tackle the new book, we can talk about some of your changes in thinking. But just to give our listeners a sense of your ideas about evolution and kinship circa 1975 when you wrote Sociobiology.
Yeah, let me give you a thumbnail and listeners a thumbnail review. In 1971, actually, I first put together what we know about the biology of the origin of social behavior in animals. But then in 1975, I expanded that to include all of the vertebrate animals and then human beings. Sociobiology, then, is a discipline. It's the scientific study, systematic study, if you wish, of the biological basis of social behavior in all kinds of organisms, including humans. It is a discipline. It came to be distorted in some of the discussions into the definition of it as the belief that human beings have instincts, but some of our behavior is biologically based. And that was anathema in the 1970s. That was the blank slate era when social scientists and many others believed that there was no such thing as human nature, no such thing as human instincts. Well, that was quickly overturned, the blank slate view. And we've advanced very far now through cognitive psychology, through human genetics, through anthropology to establish beyond any doubt that human beings are strongly affected by instinctive urges.
My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding of the criticism at that time was that this new approach suggested that human behavior is somewhat determinative, by virtue of this being biologically determined, that's where the criticism was from the folks who favored a more blank slate approach.
That was a semantic pitfall the critics fell into.
Yes.
The instincts in humans generally occur through predispositions to learn certain things as opposed to other things. And some of these predispositions are very powerful. As for example, learning a language or acquiring a phobia, or maybe a little less powerful but still very distinct, selecting a certain kind of environment for a preferred habitat, and so on through a long series of these learning predispositions, or what psychologists call prepared learning, or if you have a strong tendency not to pick up something, counter-prepared learning. So that is that's the way it's expressed in the human cultures that have learning that's forced a great deal of flexibility on the way the instincts are expressed.
So we've laid out a little bit of what the thinking was like in the 1970s. One of the big themes in the coverage of your current book, The Social Conquest of Earth, has been this idea that you have rethought some of your own ideas, or that perhaps you are overturning some of your own conventional wisdom, if that's not too strong of a statement. Just to give our readers, our listeners a sense, what led you to rethink the ideas for this new book?
Evidence. It's grown very strongly in the last 10 to 20 years against the theme that kin selection is the driving force. It's the central force and influence in the origin of social behavior generally, including animals and humans. That seemed to be the case 40 years ago, when we had very limited evidence about social insects as well as humans. But now it's been tipping the other way. Let me just review something that clarifies it.
Sure.
We see three kinds of forces as part of natural selection. That is, those forces, events, those pressures from around the environment and sometimes from within the bodies of organisms, that make certain genes survive and have more offspring. And these forces then direct generation by generation the frequencies of the genes that have these determining effects. And therefore, the traits. There are three such forces that are recognized, always have been. And those are individual-level selection. That's the classical Darwinian. That's the selection that comes from individual versus individual, say, within the same group, and their offspring. and that's just natural selection is understood in non-social and social organisms. The second one is group selection, which is the natural selection occurring during competition between groups. And the third is kin selection, which is the selection that occurs when kin favor kin. And particularly, it's defined to mean collateral kin. If you're favoring your offspring, well, that's traditional and thoroughly established form of natural selection. That you look after your offspring. But do you have collateral relatives, your siblings, your cousins, your uncle, aunt, so on? And kin selection then means, particularly, it's the only sensible way to define it, is that it's natural selection that comes from these kin taking care of each other. And that was thought at first for reasons that, please, let's not go into unless it's asked for, because it can get pretty technical, for reasons that suggested that, particularly in the social insects, this was what was happening. The evidence supporting that has gradually fallen away. And the theory behind it, which was thought to be sound, has proven to be mathematically unsound. And the reason why there's a new controversy is that after a few years of my and doubts expressed in various peer-selected, peer-reviewed publications, and the rising doubts of a few others, we finally decided to take a deep look at the roots of kin selection, whether it works, whether it's valid. And in 2 years ago, I joined with two mathematicians of the first rank at Harvard, and we went down to the bottom, and we looked at all the evidence, and we found, up to beyond, I think, any reasonable doubt, the kin selection.
Professor Wilson, we have to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue talking about your work and also take your calls. So please stay with us.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from SIT Graduate Institute, putting passion into practice with internationally focused master's degree programs, hosting an open house on May 4th. Information at sit.edu. And from Home Healthcare Hospice and Community Services, presenting Walk-In Wednesday, May 2nd, with information about home care in southwestern New Hampshire, hcsservices.org. More with Pulitzer Prize-winning sociobiologist E.O. Wilson on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, The Politics of Domestic Violence Laws. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny and milder. High temperatures from 55 in the North Country, ranging to 60 to 65 degrees in the rest of the state. Tonight, clouding up, lows dropping down to around 30 in the North Country, ranging to around 40 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis from SNHU, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we're talking with renowned biologist and author E.O. Wilson about his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us a short email to theexchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. And picking up with our discussion, Professor Wilson, I want to talk a little bit about the trade-offs inherent in your work between individual traits and group behavior. I get a sense from your writing that individual traits are often things that we think of as undesirable: greed, lust, envy, you know, the classic sins. But group behavior is typically described as being virtuous or altruistic. Is this always the case, or are there individual traits that are desirable and group behaviors that are undesirable? And how does that work with group selection?
Well, actually, it's not too far off the mark. I'm going to give you two, and the listeners, just two little statements. They're a bit oversimplified, but they get the idea across. And it's as follows. Within groups, selfish individuals beat altruistic groups. But between groups, and there's competition between groups. Altruistic groups, that is, groups consisting of altruistic individuals, beat groups of selfish individuals. So you can see there's a contest there. Individual selection, that is, individuals looking after their themselves and their offspring, often generate selfish behavior. It's not necessarily sinful, but it's natural that the individual and the immediate family, particularly the descendants, form a group that's looking after each other.
Go ahead.
But that makes them, individually centered, often selfish behavior. But in the case of group versus group, it's the virtues that are most effective. That is, virtues toward among the members of the group. So to bring it even more simplified, you might say that individual level selection favors sin. Group level selection favors virtue.
What does this say about? I was thinking of perhaps membership in a political hate group or participation in a murderous regime of some sort. We don't typically think of that behavior as virtuous or altruistic, but it is a sacrifice for the goals of a larger group. How do you account for that type of group behavior that we typically would not think of as altruistic or virtuous? It's not necessarily selfish either, though, because there is an element of personal sacrifice.
Yeah, you've come quickly to the heart of it. Virtue, in this case, as favored by group, against group selection, is largely selective altruism, that is, it's directed to other members of the group. When groups are pitted against groups, then the reverse of that often occurs. You get competition expressed in hostility, territoriality, and this can quickly escalate into racial bias and religious bias.
Let's take a phone call now. We're going to go to Steve in Nottingham. Steve, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. And I'm a sociologist, and I want to take a bigger picture. There's always a debate about how civilizations advance. And the great question is, how do human beings, Homo sapiens, differ from any other species? And I think the thing I like to argue is not the thumb and not things like that, but it's more, and not even the frontal cortex, but the ability of language and to record language, which allows one generation to pass information on to the next generation. And therefore, using that information, societies evolve and evolution takes place. So I see sociology and society as the basis of human evolution.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Professor, why don't you talk a little bit more? You mentioned the language as being integral. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, my colleague is describing is a result, not the cause. In other words, what we need to know also is how it came about and what were the forces of the evolution that created the capacity for language. Language and the accoutrements of culture, of course, the reason why humanity has been as fully dominant as it became. But then it leaves open the question of how it all happened. And what I've tried to do in this latest book is to answer the question that biologists and social scientists actually have never addressed, which is, why did it take so long? It took a long, long time for youth sociality, that is, these advanced societies, to occur in animals, including insects and other creatures where it occurs. And it took an even longer time for it to occur in a large animal capable of evolving a large forebrain and the capacity for immense amounts of stored information and the language that generates culture.
Steve,
but that doesn't change the basic picture of what were the causes and the answer of why did it take so long.
Steve, thanks for that call. Again, I want to let our listeners know you can call into the exchange at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email the exchange, exchange@nhpr.org. And we're speaking with E.O. Wilson, author of Social Conquest of Earth. Professor, I want to go back to talking a little bit more about groups in society. I'm a political scientist by training, so your book, The Conquest of Earth, had all sorts of political implications for me. And we've talked a little bit about the role of hate groups and the role of selective altruism. I guess my first question is, what is the role of government in group selection? Does it have the ability to choose winners and losers in terms of groups?
Would you repeat that question?
Sure. My question is, in talking about group membership in society, what's the role of government? Does government have the ability to choose winners and losers? And does that in any way interfere with kind of the evolution of group selection?
I guess by group that you're referring particularly to higher levels of group organization, that is federal, state. But of course, we have government and the same phenomenon, basically, even in the smallest groups. Groups that are governed by standards and rules they are obedient to the same principles of organization that you have at higher levels. And that certainly is a result of group selection. There are two general behaviors of human beings that are so powerful, so overwhelming, and so universal that we sometimes think about them almost just as parts of nature, like war and water and air. And one of them is our intense desire to form groups and the quickness with which we assume or like to think of the group we form and belong to as superior. And the second powerful human drive is to read intention of other people, to know about other people's behaviors, how to read them, how to lead the cooperation, how to lead the control, alliances, how to avoid insubordination, treachery. This is the stuff of the humanities, and actually it's the product of one of the most powerful human propensities that ever evolved.
Let's take another call. Tricia from Temple, welcome to the exchange.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Wilson, I was wondering if there could have been an evolution from kinship identity and kinship selection to the group selection, because our societies are so much more mobile and whatnot that it's harder and harder to have a kin identity.
Yes, this is one of the reasons why kin selection really doesn't work very well. But in the key paper, which was published by my two colleagues here at Harvard, heavily vetted by the journal Nature, I might add, as well as others they consulted, we showed mathematically that the starting assumption of kin selection is called the Hamilton inequality, is mathematically unsound. It was a very difficult mathematical problem to solve, but it's unsound. It does not lead. Well, it can lead to kin favoring kin, but that doesn't lead to evolution of advanced social behavior. And the other reason why we've abandoned it is that virtually all of the cases that have been reported as evidence for kin selection leading to advanced social behavior in animals can be explained better by individual selection or combined individual and group selection. So this is the reason why we have had to move away from kin selection. It just doesn't work. If it did work, there are certain extreme conditions under which it might work, but if it did work, it's much more likely to just create nepotism within a society and therefore dissolve society.
Professor Wilson, just to make sure that our listeners are clear, so you're essentially talking about mathematical models of kinship, and that was showing that mathematically you couldn't prove that kinship was a driving force?
Well, you could prove that the opposite, that kin selection cannot be a driving force. The original proposition under which most theory of kin selection is based sounds good. It says that you're going to get cooperative or altruistic behavior, providing that the good that you do to a collateral kin, that's, you know, sibling, whatever, the good that you do them by your altruistic act results in their having more offspring. That's the Darwinian advantage. Then you lose by being the altruist. And that has to be then weighted by the amount of the degree of kinship. In other words, the more distant kinship, the more altruistic you have to be in order to, the more benefit you have to give them to overcome the altruism you provide them. And that just doesn't work. If you think about it intuitively, it doesn't seem to be a likely explanation of advanced social behavior. We haven't mentioned the real reason why all the creatures known to be have advanced social organization have gotten to that stage. So maybe I should say that if we have time.
Sure, and let me just thank Tricia for that call and let our listeners know you can join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Professor Wilson, continue.
Yeah, this is a key element in the new approach to understanding origin of human behavior and also animal social behavior, and that is... when I reviewed, and no one had done this before, strangely, in all these discussions and debates about the origin of advanced social behavior, but when I reviewed all of the known cases of the origin of advanced social behavior, we call it eusocial behavior, where individuals are dividing labor, at least in part, on the basis of altruistic behavior toward each other or toward the group, there are about 24 of them in the history of life. It's quite a rare condition. And every one, no exception, arrived at the eusocial condition by going through a series of steps, culminating in solitary or mated individuals forming creating a defensible nest from which they forage to bring food to young and raise them progressively to maturity. And when you reach that stage, you're just one mutation away. That is a mutation that would silence the dispersal from creating a primitive eusocial society. Now, that's remarkable that this is invariant in the evolutionary story. We don't have many evolutionary stories that consistent. So when we come to humans and then look at the substantial amount of evidence on pre-human evolution, then we find the stage at which the brain began to increase very swiftly from the chimpanzee level at about 3 million to 2 million years ago. At that point, something else happened that we now have a good idea of, and that was that the lines, the Haviline lines of prehumans at that level, began to include meat and hunting as an important part of their life, a lifestyle. And with hunting and the consumption of meat came campfire. And many anthropologists see that as a key event in the origin of modern humanity. But I see it as the key change that led to the rapid advance in the brain size and human social evolution.
You talk in the book about a number of these preconditions and that it's actually a very small number of species that actually make all the appropriate turns to get to the point of a eusocial or a true social grouping. I wanted to follow up on that with a question about sort of the complex nature of society in terms of groups. You know, we can think about most people belonging to political groups and economic groups and religious or cultural groups. So our lives are a function of multiple group membership. And I wanted to get a sense of are there any rules about how behavior towards one group might dominate membership or altruistic behavior towards the others? Is there kind of a hierarchy of political groups, economic groups, religious groups, et cetera, or are they all kind of separate?
That's a question I'll leave to the sociologist, because indeed you know, the group formation and group rivalries have become far more complex. But there does seem to be one rule that that social psychologists have worked out experimentally that helps explain what you complexity you just mentioned. And that is that human beings form groups very, very quickly and easily. And when you form groups arbitrarily as part of an experiment, you get two groups and you divide them at random among volunteers and then have them play simple games very quickly. The two groups, even though they know what's going on, start thinking of the other group as less trustworthy and less capable. And so this is how we can break apart into endless numbers of groups at many, many levels. However, the rule that we follow is that when the whole of them faces stress, like a territorial invader in war or some great regional rivalry, even in sports teams, these groups unite and perform as one group. So the hierarchies that's created is subject to coalescence, moving up from small groups to larger groups, depending on the where the stress comes from.
I was fascinated in the book by your comments about God, creation myths, and the role of religion. Could you say a few words briefly before our next break about how you view the role of religion in group affiliation?
I think it's pretty obvious that religions are constantly at odds with one another, even though they try in interfaith coalition to do things together. It's extremely difficult, not because of religion itself, not because of, you know, transcendent, our belief in the transcendent, theological issues of whether there's an afterlife, whether there's a creator, and so on. They differ because of their creation stories. Every religion has its own creation story in which supernatural events occurred and made that tribe that accepts the creation story superior to other tribes. And no matter how we shadow it and give it nuance, this is how actually religions, organized religions, react to each other.
Professor, we need to take one more short break. We'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation with E.O. Wilson, so please stay with us.
Nowadays, science and religion do daily battle.
The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown blew that battleground wide open.
Both vying to be that infallible source from which we draw our truth.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Join Dan and me at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on May 18th. Tickets and information for this special benefit for writers on a New England stage are at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the Joslin Diabetes Center affiliate at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, offering comprehensive diabetes care to patients across southeastern New Hampshire. FrisbeeHospital.com. And Vermont Academy, creating confident and independent learners from throughout New England and beyond. Accept the applications in selected grades. Online at VermontAcademy.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we explore the state of our water in New Hampshire and effects to protect the resource. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. Today, we're talking with E.O. Wilson about his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. Professor Wilson, we have an email from Thomas Dimbeau. And Thomas is a biologist by profession. And here's what he says. I think we agree that the relentless destruction of the biosphere by humanity is the greatest challenge confronting us. I think we also agree that understanding human nature is the key to turning the tide. How do we use this insight to overcome our more selfish individual selection influences and hopefully save life on Earth? Pretty dramatic question there, Professor. Your reaction?
Well, I think that question goes right to the heart of it all. It explains why, by implication, why. We have to understand who we are and where we came from. What is human nature and how do we get this way in order to understand why we're destroying the rest of life? And we are destroying it. If we continue at this rate, most experts in the field say that we'll be down to about half of the species of plants and animals by the end of the century. So why are we so destructive? Well, first of all, we are so destructive in part because of this a very deep, innate tribal rivalry that by in which what created us, which is group selection in our present form, is also what constitutes one of the greatest dangers, that is tribal conflict. And we really need to understand why we're destroying the rest of life so recklessly. It almost certainly had something to do with the advantage that's always given humans to clean out the environment, change it, and conform it to human needs, one species needs. This seems to be within us and not easily modified. So the solution to all this is, one, come to some kind of an understanding. We need a lot more science, a lot more discussion of what human nature is, how it originated, why we are here, how we got here, and then why we've been so consistently horrific toward each other and destructive to the rest of life.
Going back to our discussion a little bit earlier about language, we have another email from Michael, and Michael writes, I would like to ask Professor Wilson why he views what he describes as a predisposition for language makes the theories of B.F. Skinner, the behavioralist, more right than the views expressed by Steven Pinker in such works as The Language Instinct. It certainly seems
correct.
Yeah, he says, it certainly seems to me that people develop complex language before it could be taught or learned. Could you, in answering that question, could you give our listeners a little bit of a background on this debate between Skinner and Pinker and how you weigh in on it?
I think it was between Skinner and Chomsky. Pinker was just describing basically the ideas of Chomsky. In the late 1950s, Chomsky brought out a critique of Skinner's a treatment of language as being completely learned. That was the radical behaviorism of B.F. Skinner of the day. Chomsky said, no, there's an innate grammar by which we acquired language. We have instincts to acquire a particular universal grammar, he called it. And that idea has prevailed until the turn of this century, say, up to 10, 20 years ago. And if you look through, as I have done, the research literature, I'm talking about the primary research literature, done by people who are doing experiments on language and comparing languages and languages that have evolved independently, like certain Creole and invented sign languages and so on. We find, and doing sound theory on how grammatical rules might evolve, it comes out that Chomsky probably is wrong. That what is inherited is a powerful propensity to create languages, and that grammar usually follows just a simple rule of action that is governed by visual stimuli. That is, you see something, you want to do something, you go for yourself, you have an action, and you have an object. And that's where the preponderance of grammar probably comes from, and not from in any grammar. So it would appear that Skinner was most, in my judgment, that is from the literature and experimental work in the last 10, 20 years, that Skinner was mostly right and Chomsky was mostly wrong.
We're talking with E.O. Wilson about his book, The Social Conquest of Nature. You can join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. What do you think of the idea that we need more than family, we need family, and that we also need groups to survive as a species? How do you think group affiliation has helped or hurt humanity? How do you understand the roles of groups in the age-old debate of nature versus nurture? And Professor Wilson, we have an interesting email from Anna Marie in Temple. And she says, if kinship is not used to define a group, what is? How does a group decide who is in and who is out in establishing its identity?
Yes, well, family is one way of defining a group. But it's not the only way. And, of course, groups form within families, of close related individuals, and they can even be at war with one another. And family groups tend to be very powerful, particularly under certain social circumstances, as, for example, when there's a recent movement of a family group into a new environment. But that's only one way to form groups. It's one that's invariant, particularly in parent, offspring, and direct lineage groups. But it's only one of many kinds of groups, and even with those, it can see division and conflict.
And this email actually leads to a question that I had about the nuclear family. We hear a lot about the importance of the nuclear family and familiar interaction. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is you're not necessarily saying that because kinship ties are not the driving force. You're not saying that families don't matter. I mean, it sounds like you're saying that families and groups coexist, but it's the larger group membership that really ultimately drives selection. Is that correct?
Oh, that's correct. The remember that direct lineage is Darwinian, individual-level selection. That's one category of selection, and that's extremely powerful, direct lineage. But kin selection comes in and seems to add something important, or seem to, using collateral relatives as part of the powerful selection force. And that turns out not to be true, at least not to the extent of being responsible for creating groups consistently or driving social evolution to the high level we see in humans.
So the nuclear family is still important. It's just we're less focused.
Absolutely.
On our, extended family. Yeah.
No, I certainly would not want to imply anything else.
Something that caught my attention in your book as well that I'd like you to talk a little bit about is the idea of culture and the relationship between human instinct and things like the creation of art, music, dance. You talk about Gauguin in your introduction. You tell a story. How does that work?
Well, first of all, in order to understand culture, you need to understand exactly how natural selection works when it affects social behavior. And there are genes. They program behaviors or propensities to behavior or the various multiple physiological changes that induce forms of behavior and so on. And then there are targets in selection. Those are the traits that are evinced by the behavior in this case that's usually shown. There are different degrees of flexibility in the expression of the genes through those traits. Culture is a form of extreme flexibility with the added trait of being transmitted across generations, through among people and across generations, which changes enormously the environment and the degree of flexibility that's possible. But there's still an instinctual subtrait which consists of predispositions, many of them extremely strong, to learn certain things and to have certain cultural features in the evolving cultures as opposed to others. And our cultures really are very peculiar when you look at the things I've been mentioning, you know, about the power of group formation,
right,
group hostility, the origin of religion, and so on.
Great. Let's take a call now. We have Cynthia standing by in Plymouth. Cynthia, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. My name is Cindy, and I am a second-grade teacher, and I have been teaching for over 25 years. And everything that you've said is very fascinating to me. And I feel that, as an educator, the place where we need to make the move towards understanding exactly what you're saying and putting it to use is in education, and it's something that I feel strongly about in my own classroom. I tend to have a lot of children with different needs and then very bright children at the same time in my classroom and have this wonderful mix many years. And what I've found is that you can coach the group to begin to bond and to appreciate each other's strengths and weaknesses and to support each other. But it takes a lot of coaching in the very beginning because the children come in. I teach second grade, so they're still very young, and they're kind of malleable in terms of what you do with your coaching. And so what I've done is embrace things like the theory of Howard Gardner, where you have the multiple intelligences, and you teach the children that everybody has their things that can be appreciated about what they can do or what they know or whatever and what to share. So rather than the way that I was educated, where everything was sort of competitive, if you create instead an environment within the classroom where you are looking at individual differences and appreciating that, over time, what I see about the group is that they become closer if I emphasize that this is more a family where we spend more time sometimes than what an actual family spends together, and that we have to respect each other and that sort of thing, and kind of do that coaching with them. What happens is that I can stand back now at this time of year and observe my children, and if a child is having difficulty in a certain area, another child will just, it appears to me to almost be instinctively want to help the other child and go over and sit with that child and help and do that sort of thing. So,
Cindy, let's let the professor jump in here. So, Professor, the question is about the teachability of children to belong in groups and to have favorable group dynamics in the classroom.
I think that's extraordinarily insightful, and I believe that's actually not just a better way to teach, but also a lot of a better way to reduce group between group and between individual hostility. One of the problems, or should say the most fascinating aspect of human behavior that the new theory, and I think this new theory is far more, it's sound and it's likely to stay sound, is that there is an eternal conflict between individual-level selection and group-level selection. That means that our humans are innately conflicted, and they're not going to ever change. So we have to work out not a perfect system, political, religious, or educational, but rather ways of reducing the conflicted nature to allow people to broaden as individual humans. And if we have time, I'm not sure. I'd like to just tell you something rather amazing. One of the results that has come out of social psychology studies recently.
Sure, we have
How
about,
we do on time? Have I got 2 minutes?
Yeah, Professor, you're exactly right. We have just about 2 minutes left in the show. Cindy, thanks for that call. So please, go ahead.
Okay, this is important, particularly with reference to the teacher we just heard from. In a massive study published about 2 years ago, in Science by some 50 authors around the world, personality studies and ability studies were analyzed in cultures of very different cultures of some 30 countries or so. And it was found that in those traits, which we know are inherited in part of personality, that one sees in an average classroom, for example, the societies around the world, from Burkina Faso to Japan to Angola and so on, are virtually identical. In other words, the same variety of people is found in each culture. And each human societies are basically the same from one to the next. Now, that is science. It's not just an ideological hope. And it's one that we should be building on, I think, in understanding the human condition.
Professor, we have just about a minute left. You end your book with the question, where are we going? A brief thumbnail for our listeners about where you think we're going in the future?
I pointed out, well, something we all know, that since science and technology alone is doubling in content every 10 to 20 years, and it's changing everything in the way we communicate, global communication and understanding across groups and so on. We can't say where we're going, but we can pick out a couple of things where maybe we should not be going. We certainly should not be continuing the kind of reckless destruction of the natural world. We should be thinking twice about sending people into space. We don't need to do that. And we will never, ever leave this planet because we don't have to. We can turn this planet into a permanent, sustainable paradise if we wish and if we find the way. So I think a list of things of where not to go could be helpful, but we can't predict exactly where, in fact, we will go.
A very interesting and provocative way to end our conversation. Professor Wilson, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really enjoyed talking with you. That's Professor E.O. Wilson, author of The Social Conquest of Earth. He joined us this morning from his home in Lexington, Massachusetts. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.